This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, the Liberal leader dials in from the other end of Nova Scotia to get you up to speed on the opposition's point of view. If you're a big Queen fan but you never saw their show, we'll tell you about the next best thing. But up first, the CBRM's Michael Roos on trying to deal with rats in and around your community.
CBRM has provided an issue paper regarding municipal rodent control. So as noted on January 17th, Council passed a motion for staff to prepare a report on options for how CBRM can assist with the controlling and or eliminating of rodents, specifically rats in the CBRM. Council noted that rodents can cause a variety of problems in municipalities, including damage to buildings, transmission of diseases, and contamination of food supplies. In this report, staff have explored several options that can be used to control and or eliminate rodent populations in the municipality. In Nova Scotia, rodent populations are primarily controlled through the efforts of individual property owners and tenants, with the support and guidance provided by the provincial government and municipalities. Rodent management is a complex issue and requires expert knowledge of rodent biology and risks associated with chemical use, integrated pest management practices, and rodent control devices. Management control programs face challenges due to this complexity. A key component to studied rodent management programs is public education to inform the public of methods to mitigate rat populations. Individual property owners and tenants are responsible for controlling rodents on their property and preventing infestations from spreading to neighboring properties. They can take several steps to control rodent populations, primarily including maintaining clean and sanitary conditions. At the municipal level, CBRM has various departments that have been dealing with rodent issues. These issues are cross-departmental, involving parks and recreation, building and inspections, and solid waste. Rodent management current practices are as follows. CBRM practices for municipal baiting occurring as required on municipal properties. Building inspections respond to unsightly properties with food sources such as garbage or unkept properties by issuing notices for the property owner to clean the property. The minimum standards bylaw requires property owners to secure dwellings in tenant-occupied premises to prevent the infestation of rodents. CBRM solid waste resource management bylaw requires residents to maintain adequate containers for waste collections to mitigate potential food sources for rodents. And lastly, we facilitate community cleanup programs to reduce habitats for rodent activities. So, we've included a variety of options for Council's consideration at this point in time. Those are provided starting on page 150 and ending on page 151. These are education, community programming, and the most resource-intensive option being an integrated pest management program. So with all those options in consideration, our recommendation is as follows. Rodents are considered a complex and cross-departmental issue. Controlling rodent populations should focus on the reduction of food sources and habitats. Municipal efforts in CBRM have focused on controlling rodent populations through a variety of departmental strategies. However, further work at a neighborhood level is required to rodent-proof buildings, eliminate potential habitats, and remove food sources. Community-wide efforts to reduce habitats and food sources may reduce the current rodent population. CBRM can support an education campaign outlining methods of rodent-proofing buildings and decreasing rodent access to those food supplies. It is therefore recommended that CBRM Council direct CBRM staff to develop an educational campaign providing guidance to property owners on how to mitigate rodent issues on private property. If Council wishes to escalate the issue further, Council should consider advocating for provincial operational funding to retain a consultant for the purposes of implementing an integrated pest management program, such as those pioneered in other jurisdictions. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Director. We'll go to Councillor Gordon MacDonald.
Thanks, Madam Mayor, and thanks, Michael, for the director for the report. You know, even today I was getting calls about rats around bird feeders. So, you know, regularly you're getting calls around the demolitions that happen, green bins, you know, bird feeders and garbage that's around property. So I like what you have in the report. The fact that you talk about education as being the first thing, I think that's very important. And I think it's one of the things that we should be doing, you know, to educate, because I think it's education that's really going to help, not what we're doing as a municipality, but what the residents and, you know, and how they can go to help mitigate the huge number of rats that we have in different areas of this municipality. So, you know, everything that I was looking for in this report, and I also thank you for coming back with it so fast. It's good to be able to have this coming into the spring season, and, you know, maybe some of that information will get out to the public, you know, kind of soon in that regard. Having said that, I would like to put the recommendation forward that the CBRM Council direct staff to develop an educational campaign to provide guidance to property owners on how to mitigate rodent issues on private property. And I don't think at this time we need to look at a provincial operational thing, you know, but it's there in the background in case we need to come back at it later if education doesn't seem to kind of alleviate some of the issues. So I would like to put that first motion forward, and yeah, thanks for doing this.
Okay, that was moved by Councillor Gordon MacDonald, seconded by Councillor Ken Tracy. I think you were first up there. On that motion, Councillor Dernoquin?
I'll wait for it.
Okay. Any further discussion on the motion?
Question
has been called. Council, please proceed to vote. And motion is carried. Thank you kindly. Councillor Dernoquin, to continue discussion.
Thanks, Madam Mayor. Thanks, Mike, too. Councillor McDonald mentioned green bins, and last time this came up, I mentioned green bins as well. The old ones had the vent. The new ones we're putting out now, are they vent free? Do we know? Or
Yes, they are. So the vents are actually in a different place. They're underneath where you don't see them or have the same grating that the old green bins have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Councillor Steve Gillespie.
Thank you, Mayor McDougall. Mayor, and my apologies for coughing through this entire evening. I appreciate the work that Councillor Gordon MacDonald has done on this, as well as the Planning Department, and not a question, but more of a shot at my favorite director, Michael Roos. Since I usually wait 3 or 4 years for my issue papers to come back, I'm going to ask Gordon MacDonald to now be in charge of my issue papers, if that's okay with Council. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Gillespie.
Six bills were passed in the spring session of the Nova Scotia Legislature after 14 days. The government's budget includes $14.5 billion in expenses. That's $6.5 billion, which is related to healthcare in the form of services, wages, construction projects, and bonuses for nurses. Liberal leader Zach Churchill said the government's budget leaves the most vulnerable people worse off. He catches up with Dave DeVoe to tell you about the opposition's reaction to the spring sitting.
So first off, Zach, we're talking just after the spring sitting wrapped up. I guess I'll just get your summary of the sitting, how you think it went, and anything else you want to say about how it proceeded, I guess.
Well, I've got some real worries about the provincial budget that was just passed. I don't think that it's going to improve the situation in healthcare. And I'm also worried that some of the measures in the budget are actually going to increase the problems in our healthcare system because people may get sicker. The provincial government has frozen income assistance for 2 years in a row. Of course, with inflation going up, that's going to make the most financially vulnerable in our province more vulnerable. And we know when that happens, people do get sicker. They get depression, they get anxiety, other health issues occur. There was also nothing in the budget to deal with the growing food insecurity that we have in Nova Scotia. And we know that 50% of people that don't take their prescription pills, it's because of food insecurity. As a result, people get sicker and show up in our hospitals. And we really didn't see any major measures to increase affordable housing. And in fact, the government made it harder for people to get rent supplements to even help pay for the higher rents that we're seeing in the province. So when you look at the big factors that are impacting people's health, food, housing, and income, those situations are going to get worse, and I worry that more people are going to get sick, show up at our hospitals, and that's going to put more pressure on our healthcare system.
Okay, a number of issues you brought up there. First of all, on the affordable housing issue, the government says actually, in absolute terms, it's investing more in affordable housing. I guess the issue is whether or not new housing was offered in the budget, but there's still more money being offered in absolute terms, is there not?
They've put more money into rent supplements. That's what people can apply for to get help to pay for their rent. However, they've changed the income criteria. So before, where if your rent was 30% of your income, you could apply for rental supplements. Now you can't unless you're paying 50% of your income on rent. That's a problem. That means there's going to be thousands of people in Nova Scotia who are benefiting from that program who now won't be able to. And it's going to put more financial strain on people. And again, people are literally making decisions between paying their power bills, buying their medications, or buying food. And if we're not paying attention to these fundamental issues, there's a risk that more people are going to get sick, and that's going to put a lot more strain on our healthcare system. And so I really worry about this. I think it's something we should be paying attention to, because we're not going to fix our healthcare system if we don't help people be healthier, particularly those that are the most vulnerable.
So, in other words, is this a money issue largely? Like, do you think more money should have been put into putting new affordable housing in this budget?
They certainly should have indexed income assistance to inflation so people can keep up. We believe they shouldn't have made this change in rental supplements, because less people are going to get support when they need it most to keep shelter over their heads. And there was nothing in this budget to deal with food insecurity. We, on the other hand, did put forward 26 bills in the legislature, many of which actually tackle these issues. We think this is a time to actually increase income assistance, because people are going to really struggle through this time. We've also presented a plan to lower income taxes so more people have money in their pockets and less financial strain in their daily lives. And we also brought legislation forward that would bring a lunch program to our schools so that all the kids in our schools will have access to healthy food. And we know that's just not important for learning, but it's also important for people's health. And these things are all linked to health outcomes. You know, people that are food insecure have more stomach issues. They have anxiety and depression. They have more likelihood of getting diabetes and having cardiovascular issues. When people are stressed out about their money and can't make ends meet, they also deal with depression, anxiety, and other health issues. And of course, if you can't access housing, and that is a major problem right now for a lot of Nova Scotians, that is one of the most stressful situations at all, if you can't find shelter overhead. And we have the highest rates of homelessness now in Nova Scotia. And for those that even are in housing, it's becoming less affordable for them and putting more financial pressures on.
So at the moment, everyone's saying increasing supply is going to be the main sort of tool to address this. And I think there's some acknowledgement of that, I guess, across the political spectrum, at least among the parties in the House. But there's a debate over, you know, to what extent should the rent cap be a tool here? To what extent should other tools be used, versus to what extent should it simply be a matter of increasing supply and putting policies in place that increase supply. The argument goes putting in policies that incentivize developers will increase supply. Like what mix of those tools are you envisioning if you had the levers here?
We certainly need to increase supply. We have a very unhealthy vacancy rate in Nova Scotia. Like, no matter what area of the province you go in, people are having a hard time finding places to live. An issue with the rent cap right now is people who are new to the rental market are actually seeing much higher rents because they're almost subsidizing people that are on the rent cap. So any new people coming into the rental market are paying, in some cases, above market rents for places, for their place to live, right? And that's creating additional financial strain on people. So there does need to be money for new housing. Housing was barely even mentioned in the budget. And we certainly need to be creating more non-market housing. And that can be done either through, you know, building more public housing or actually incentivizing like the not-for-profit sector or the profit sector to develop more affordable non-market housing. And I certainly don't think we saw enough of that.
If you listen to what people in the housing sector are saying, I know recently there was a landlord that testified before a legislature committee. I forget which committee it was, but she said that even the rent cap is killing landlords right now. And even having the rent cap in place is not only hurting landlords, but indirectly hurting prospective tenants. Do you think that's true, or what's your position on the rent cap?
We certainly think the current rent cap that's in place was meant to be temporary, and it is creating issues on the supply side, and it also has the potential to hurt the people that it's trying to help. You know, new people coming into the market, they're paying much higher rents, so even if they're being capped with their rent, they're starting off with a much higher rental position. And we really do have to rethink this. We did present legislation that would get the politics out of rent control, put it into an independent entity like the UARB, and they can evaluate what rental increases should be. So you can have a regulated market, but not an arbitrary cap. And that will do a better job of protecting people, but also not jeopardizing housing supply, which we really need right now. And that would end once we get back to a healthy vacancy number, which would be about 3%, is what experts say is a healthy vacancy in a province. So once we get to that, you know, government can get out of that market. But until we do, there's still going to be challenges for people, either because they're dealing with high rents, or on the landlord side, they're not being incentivized to create more affordability units or more housing overall.
Okay. I want to switch sort of back to healthcare here because, as you say, all these issues are related, right? On healthcare, as I'm sure you're aware, the family doctor waitlist numbers just came out today. You've commented publicly on them, but I guess I'll just, before we dig more deeply into the matter, just get you to comment on what you think about the latest numbers.
Well, we've seen the numbers double under Houston for the amount of people that don't have a family doctor. This is creating more strain in our hospitals. More people are showing up to our ERs. They're not being monitored on a regular basis, so people can also get sicker. And they're trying to access healthcare in other ways and overloading our emergency rooms, overloading our walk-in clinics, and overloading the mobile clinics and virtual clinics that are in place to help people without a family doctor. So one of the root causes of these issues is access to a family practitioner. And this government has essentially given up on even looking at that issue. They've cut the family doctor incentive. They have not created one collaborative care clinic in the 2 years they've been in government. And the premier said this session of the legislature that the days of having a family doctor in your lifetime are coming to an end. So, I mean, this is a big problem. The more people that don't have a family doctor, the more pressures we're going to see in our hospitals, and potentially the more sicker people are going to be too, because they're not being monitored, particularly those with complex health issues. So this is a big problem, and it seems that the Houston government has kind of given up on even trying to get people a family doctor.
Okay. One thing I'd like to pick up on there is you referenced the incentive, the canceling of the incentive down the central zone. There is sort of a Cape Breton spin to this, I guess, because Dr. Oral, who's from Sydney, as you know, have said that retention program actually helped attract a lot of people to the Halifax area. But when it comes to areas like Cape Breton and other areas outside of Halifax, it wasn't working for those areas. So what do you say to people in Cape Breton who might be worried? I don't know whether it's a zero-sum game between central and eastern zone or not, but I mean, if that retention program in the central zone affects us here in the eastern zone, you know, what do you say to people who might worry about that effect?
Well, the numbers haven't gone up in the Cape Breton area either for family doctors, and more people need a family doctor, you know, and the fact is that everybody in all of the regions outside of Halifax also depend on services in Halifax. You know, whether it's emergency at the QE2, there's ambulances that drive from all over the province that need to go to QE2 for the issues that their patients are dealing, whether it's access to surgeries. These things are all impacted when the central zone is in chaos, right? And we've seen the numbers of people who need a family doctor shoot up exponentially in the central zone since they cut the incentives. And that is, you know, I think creating a lot of major pressure in the central zone so that the central zone isn't able to handle patients that are coming in from other parts of the province, right? So not only has them cutting that incentive made it worse in Halifax, which does impact any patient who needs to go to Halifax for services, but we haven't seen an improvement in other parts of the province. So that situation's only gotten worse as well. So, you know, something's got to give here, and we really need to get more patients attached to the family doctors, or we're not going to be able to catch up with the pressures in our hospital system.
Could it be possibly that, you know, given all the pressures we're facing, I'm partly playing devil's advocate here, I guess, but, you know, there could be a plausible case to be made that given all the pressures we're facing, the best we can hope for right now is a modest increase in the number of people waiting for family doctors, and you know, the one could, I suppose, being charitable to whatever government is in power and say, look, the best thing they can do is prevent it from going up even more than it is now. Do you think things are that bad that we can make that kind of assessment?
Well, even if we could stop those numbers from growing right now, that would be an improvement, right? We've seen the amount of people that need a family doctor double in the last 2 years. We have never seen the amount of people that need a family doctor increase that quickly in living memory. So if we could at least stop the bleeding, that certainly would be an improvement. But we do need the government to, and the premier to, accept the fact that family doctors are really important to healthcare in Nova Scotia. They're very important for patients. It's critical to keep people out of our hospitals and our emergency rooms so they can deal with the most urgent cases. And right now they seem to be kind of washing their hands of it. And I think that will continue to be a major problem for our healthcare system and for patients.
Okay. I want to sort of tie together, I guess, the health issues that we're talking about here and also the housing issues. I challenged your colleague Fred Tilley on this recently because, you know, you guys seem to be wanting more investment in housing. You're also calling for more action in healthcare, and clearly, I don't think anybody disagrees that more investment is needed there. On the other hand, there is a certain fiscal conservatism streak in the Liberal Party of Nova Scotia. I'm not sure if you guys are still committed to balanced budgets or not, but as I asked Fred, you know, how do you walk that line between, really strict fiscal prudence on the one hand, but also telling the government, you know, spend more here, spend more there, especially on big issues like housing and health?
It's not about spending more, it's about spending smart. So if we stop just hurling money to throw Band-Aids on the healthcare system and took some of those resources and help people be healthier, that's going to take a lot of strain off the healthcare system and actually be better for individuals. Like, if you talk to doctors now, the majority of people in our emergency rooms and that are hospitalized right now, they're either dealing with one of three things. They're having a hard time on the income front, they're having a hard time accessing food, or they are not able to find shelter, or are stressed out about the shelter that they have financially. So all of these factors are actually really impacting the healthcare system.
Okay, but income, I mean, if you want to help people with income, then that even targeted support is going to require more money, isn't it?
Well, of course, but it's money where you actually see a return on. You know, if you help people on the income front and help them be healthier and help them access quality food, you know, by putting food in our schools for lunch so all kids have it, whether they're low income or not, whether you're building more affordable housing units and not freezing income assistance for the most vulnerable when inflation is going up at a rate that hasn't gone up since the 80s. You know, these things are going to make people worse off and make people sicker. I think the government would be a lot smarter to actually help people make their meet their basic needs. That's going to keep people out of the hospital. It's going to keep people healthier. And we are not going to catch up with the pressures of our healthcare system until we start rethinking the whole situation. It's not about throwing Band-Aids on the healthcare system. It's actually about people's health at the heart of it. So it's not about spending more. It's about spending wisely and not just throwing money at the wall and hoping for the best, but identifying where the big problems are. And right now, it's an illness in people's health. That's where the pressure's coming from on our healthcare system.
So,
and if we put more money there, you'll have, you know, better outcomes down the road.
So you feel if this was a liberal budget, the amount of money invested in healthcare would have been comparable, less, more? Do you have some idea about that?
We increased investments in healthcare. You know, every single year we're in government, certainly those increases need to happen right now. There's a lot of big problems in our healthcare system. I just don't think this government has a plan on where they're spending the money. I think they're throwing money at problems instead of understanding, okay, there's deeper issues here that are affecting these problems. And if they got a bit smarter about where they're spending their money, I think we would all be better off.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Zach?
As always, it's been a great chat, David. I mean, my big concerns here is freezing income assistance, changing the rent supplement program so thousands of Nova Scotians won't be able to access that at a time they probably need it more than anything else. And we really do have to look at the issues around food security. You know, if we're not going to be looking at these kind of fundamental health issues in the province, then we're going to be chasing our tail on healthcare.
Okay. Zach, on that note, thanks once again for your time, sir, and look forward to speaking again.
Always a pleasure, man. Hope it's nice up there. It's beautiful down here in Yarmouth.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Bill Bradley's been busy behind the mic catching up with some community leaders to tell you about a couple of events coming up around the corner, starting out with one that hits close to home for us here at the coast.
Coming up on April 22nd, it's Earth Day, and we are celebrating along with Rural Communities Foundation of Nova Scotia. And with me from that organization is Executive Director Penny Cooper. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We're really excited about this event coming up.
And this event is happening right upstairs from where we are here at the Eldwig Art Center. Again, it's coming up on Saturday, April 22nd from 8:30 in the morning through until 4:45. And Penny, tell us a bit about the day and what can we expect?
Right. Well, the Rural Communities Foundation, one of our pillars of what we do is convening. So we bring people together and community groups to talk about their community and services available and the work being done in their communities. So what we're doing for this Community Impact Conference is zeroing in on climate action, because there is a lot going on in Nova Scotia with regards to climate action. And we're really excited to bring a group of over 30 presenters together to talk about what they're doing in their communities. And some of those groups have been funded by the Rural Communities Foundation, and others have been funded or are doing their own work. And this is an amazing opportunity to bring groups together to talk about what they're doing. And in the secret sauce, of course, is in between the presentations, when they talk to each other and they share information and they also share services. We just think it's a great way for Nova Scotians and the groups in Nova Scotia working on climate action to get together to talk about climate action.
So what if I'm just a regular everyday Joe, so to speak, and I'm not involved with any of the groups that are attending, but interested in attending? Is that possible?
Absolutely. We have on our webpage, so if you Google Rural Communities Foundation of Nova Scotia, we have on our page, there's a link and you can sign up for the event. It is a ticket price. It's $40 for the ticket. For the full day conference, it includes lunch and snacks, et cetera. So that's why we have to cover our costs. But it's also open to, as you say, regular Joes on the street, because we are all together involved in climate action and saving our planet. But also, you know, you can get really depressed by hearing what's going on in the news. And you think, what can I do, or what's going on around me? And this is a great opportunity to come in, hear what's going on, be uplifted by the groups around you and the people around you that are actually doing things for climate action. And who knows, you may want to participate. You may want to join a group or volunteer. This is a great way for you to find out what's happening in your backyard.
And literally in your backyard, in our community. This is for talking about the events that we have planned throughout the day for Earth Day for April 22nd and upcoming events as well. This is a way to really make a change. And I think you hit the nail right on the head. I've often heard things at times going, you know, how can I make a change and then quickly forget about it? But this is a way that you as an individual can be part of the making the change process.
Yep. Absolutely. And there's great ideas, great things that people are going to be talking about. The other thing that I want to mention about this program that we have on Earth Day is we're bringing a group of First Nations community people together to talk about what they're doing in First Nations communities, and then the relationship building that takes place between First Nation communities and other communities in Nova Scotia. And we're really excited to have Elder Albert Marshall speaking about two-eyed seeing, which is exactly this. This is seeing through the eyes of what First Nations groups are doing and then what other people are doing as well.
So how long has your group been in existence there, Penny?
Oh, we've been around for over 20 years. And we have been, we actually started through we applied for a grant when the TAGS funding stopped. And there was money left over in the TAGS funding. And that's how we started our organization. And our organization has really focused on the strengths and assets of rural Nova Scotia and helping to create diverse, equitable, and inclusion and sustainable communities. And we've been doing this by convening like these events, but also by granting funds and establishing grants as well. So we have individuals in Nova Scotia that fund grants, and one of them is the Joan Fineman family, which is funding stimulating grants that talk about climate action. So it helps to stimulate the discussion on climate action and get groups together to work on climate action.
Now, there's a lot of people talking about climate action and change with Earth Day coming up on April 22nd, but this is actually boots on the ground, people reacting to what's going on in the community, and this is a great way to do it. And again, it's coming up on April 22nd here at the Elder Wiggs Arts Center. It's between 8:30 and 4:45. And again, if you could give out the information for people that are interested in actually coming to the conference.
Yeah, absolutely. Go head on over to our website, which is rcfofns.com. Click on the Community Impact Conference page, and there's a link there to register, and it will take you to an Eventbrite page where you can register for the conference. I mean, we have lots of community groups coming, but we also would like to have lots of general public attending as well.
Penny, really appreciate this, and happy Earth Day early here coming up on April 22nd.
Thank you so much.
It's a kind of magic.
Coast 89.7 presents a tribute to Queen, It's a Kind of Magic. And the guy that plays Freddie Mercury in the Queen tribute, Dominic Warren, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
A lot of people here in Canada are so looking forward to seeing you guys again as you hit the road. Now, it's coming up on May 6th at the Savoy Theater. And just from looking at the video online, it looks like an incredible show. And might I point out that the similarities to you and Freddie Mercury are just absolutely incredible.
If you put a moustache on anything, I'm sure they look close as well.
So how many people are actually in the group?
Yeah, so on stage, we've got the four band members. We've got myself, Rusty Red, that plays Brian May, Michael Dickens, that plays Roger Taylor, and then Andre van der Merwe, that plays John Deacon on bass.
How did the idea of actually doing a Queen tribute come about?
So the show that I've joined, I've been part of it for about 4 years. It did exist before me. I just took over the lead role 4 years ago. The show's always been there, but I've always been a massive Queen fan. And when I managed to get the job, it was a dream come true.
So how do you pick, because there's so many great Queen songs?
In order to keep it as professional, as slick as possible, we obviously want to play the songs that we've played the most times. And you know, so what we do is every tour we go, we change a few songs and then we move on with that set list for the whole tour.
Now, I was researching some information online and watching some videos about the group here for the Queen tribute. And I noticed that the song, It's a Kind of Magic, you're wearing the exact same outfit as Freddie Mercury wore when he was doing that video as well, live at Wembley.
So everything in this show, we try and recreate the 1986 Wembley concert. So it's a concert a rock concert, basically, no narrative and no musical theater stories, etc. But we've got everything down to the T, like Rusty, who's on Brian May. He plays an exact replica of Brian May's guitar. I mean, I've got the exact outfits right up to the exact boxing shoes that we had to order in specially because they were discontinued. So we've really taken every detail into account when we go into stage.
So folks that have never seen you perform as the Queen tribute, what can they expect?
It's a rock concert. So what we expect from the audience is just to stand up in their chairs and sing all the Queen songs with us. And we deliver 175 to 200% energy on stage every night. And we've got all the crazy lighting, all the outlandish costumes, and this massive LED screen behind us that enhances everything with some video imagery as well.
So looking forward to the show. If you want to get your tickets, they're available right now at SavoyTheater.com. You can also call them at 842-1577. It's on Saturday, May the 6th at 7 o'clock. This sounds like an incredible show. I know the crowd here in Cape Breton Island are so looking forward to it as well.
We're excited to be there. Thank you so much for having me again.
London came an Irishman one day, as the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay, singing songs of Piccadilly and in Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited, then he shouted to them there, it's a long way to Tipperary.
In 1915, about 6 months after the start of the First World War, when Sir Robert Borden was Prime Minister, when Albert Einstein was in his prime at 36 years old, Pablo Picasso was a young man at 30. Before the start of the Great Depression, NHL, and Walt Disney Company, the song It's a Long Way to Tipperary was a Billboard hit. But more importantly, in 1915, it's when Margaret McPhee of Bedeck was born on a small farm. She recently celebrated her 108th birthday.
My heart right there.
Well, I was born on a farm at Upper Bedeck River on a stormy night. I don't know how we ever lived through it all, but anyway, farming wasn't a very easy chore in those years. And I went to the country school, of course, mile and a half away. And in some days, in the winter time, sometimes we had to go on snowshoes to get through. And maybe as the day went by, it would get stormy, and our father used to come to meet us with the horse and sleigh and take the whole school home. I remember those days, all right. And we played at school. We went out at noon and we played Stormy Weather. That's what's the name of our game. There would be one like a captain, he'd call or she would call Stormy Weather, and the rest of the kids would all come running, and he'd try to see how many he or she could tap with their hand. In the spring and in the hall, we played ball outside. In the house, we just played with one another, I guess. I didn't even have a doll when I was growing up. And I don't know how we managed when we were the worst. 11 of us in the family. In those years, there wasn't even a telephone. And if you had to get a doctor, you had to go into Bedeck to get the doctor and take him out and send him home again. So it was a hard life. We never had a television in my day until I was half as old as I am today. And when I left home, I went to Hunter's Mountain to work. There's where I left home to go to work first. Over to Hunter's Mountain. And from there, I went from home to home work. And there was an old lady in every... I thought she was old. Maybe she wasn't as old as I thought. There was an old lady in every home I went to work in. So that was the beginning of my working days, from home to home like that.
Margaret, did you ever leave Cape Breton? Did you ever work and live elsewhere?
Yes, I went to the States for a year and a half or so, to Washington, but I didn't like it there. I wouldn't want to be living there. I went with some of those Americans, the Bavaria Bells. They were looking for girls that would go back with them to work, so it was a good opportunity for me, I thought. So myself and a friend of mine went with them, and I didn't stay long. I didn't care for the state, so I came home and settled down in my own life.
You know, Margaret, going over 108 years, you've certainly seen a lot of things change with new inventions and different ways of life. When you look back, can you think of, maybe your favorite moments in history, whether it be an invention or some landmarks? What was remarkable to you during the course of 108 years?
Well, there was electricity was one change, and telephone was another change, and
television,
and radio, all those things. And I suppose there are others, but I don't remember them.
All these life experiences that you did have, Margaret, and I'm sure so many great moments in your life. Is there a story that you might be able to share with us? Something that maybe you remember from your childhood that you could tell us?
Well, one that I suppose you're getting tired hearing already is when I was a little child creeping along the floor. My father used to work in the lumber woods or in the fire, getting firewood. And he wasn't home at that day. And my mother used to look after the animals. At noon, we all had animals. And at noon, she used to go and let them out to drink and feed them and all that. So this day, that happened. And I had an older brother, two older brothers. And my mother left them in looking after me while she was out doing the animals. So she happened to come to the stable door and she saw this big smoke coming out of the flue and could smell it. So she ran in to see what was going on. And I was just toddling on the floor. And we had a chimney behind the stove and we all just threw everything there. The bark off the wood and old papers and kindling and things like that. And it was an open fireplace. And she looked and here the chimney was going on fire. And I was right up at the chimney. And my older brother had taken the other boy into a bedroom and closed the door.
Oh, thanks so much for sharing that, Margaret. That's quite a story, and what a memory that you have. You know, I have to ask you, what is the secret to your success to enjoy? How does one go about enjoying such a long and happy, healthy life, such as you are doing?
Oh, well, if I'll tell it, it won't be a secret. I can't see what I say, Lord. Well, to be happy and not to be getting into any trouble or causing trouble to themselves or their families or to other people, and just to take it a day at a time, I guess.
Margaret, I can't tell you what a great pleasure this was to speak with you and for you to share your wisdom with us. Happy belated birthday, and I hope you have many, many more.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Many, many more. I think everyone I did, but that can't be many more, I don't think. Anyway, you're very welcome, and thanks for the interview.
Graham McKenzie is a pharmacist and owner of Stone's Pharmacy in Bedeque. He and the staff have become close friends with Margaret. Graham talks about his relationship with her, how they met, and his admiration for her sharp mind and sense of humor.
Yeah, so I've been here for 30 years. I came here in 93 after I graduated from Dow. And, well, of course, Margaret was here then. And she was always somebody that, you know, seemed like one of our oldest customers, but really had no issue getting around. And you know, up until very lately, she was still coming into the pharmacy. She's would always look for something that would be maybe easier on her than, you know, a prescription pain relief thing for her arthritis, because she really doesn't have a whole lot of medical issues to speak of. And, you know, I'd give her a few things out front, and she'd claim that she was a new lady. And it's very, very, you know, if all the customers were like Margaret, we'd have a maid. Like, she's just friendly and goes along with, you know, what you suggest for her. And she's just a good person overall.
You know, Graham, I think it might be important to mention how quickly the turnaround was for this interview to happen and the willingness for Margaret to take part in this. It was, like I said, really quite an honor for us. But can you talk about that, please? I find that very impressive that in less than an hour, we were able to make this interview happen.
Yeah, not a whole lot. I mean, Bedeque is a pretty tight community, and Brett is usually my contact to get in touch with Margaret through either a family member or directly to her herself. And we've come to her house many times giving her vaccines, and we've come here for her birthdays in the past. And so what happened was, you know, when you contacted me, I just let Beth know, and she had us all set up to go in about 10 minutes. And Margaret was Margaret, you know, she doesn't have a whole lot on her docket every day, so she's always open to visitors, and she knows us, and she was comfortable with us coming out here, so we were happy to help.
So Margaret is spending a lot of time at home. Does she get the chance to get out every now and then?
She doesn't get out of her home a whole lot, especially in the wintertime. She's you know, if somebody wants to see Margaret, they come here. You know, in the summertime, it's less and less that we see Margaret out. And, you know, I think at that age, that kind of helps. You know, she gets mobility around her house, but she's mindful of, you know, not falling or anything like that. So I think she limits her time outside the house, but definitely she's no stranger to being outside.
So you've gotten to know Margaret pretty well, Graham. What is it that Margaret does differently than a lot of people to enjoy a 108th birthday?
Well, I think one thing that really helps extend your life is if you have an extended network of friends and family and people that you can connect with. And I think that's been shown for people that have cancer and survival with different types of terminal diseases. The better your extended network, then the better your outcome with your longevity. And of course, everybody in Medec knows Margaret, and she has a lot of people checking in on her. And I think that's probably a part of what it is. Like, she really honestly has no idea, I don't think, really what brought her here this long. But that has to be part of it, I think. Genetics definitely would have something to do with it. And she treated herself fairly well during her life. She wasn't hard on herself. But she mentioned to you about how hard she worked growing up, and I certainly think that put her on the path to a healthy life.
All righty, Graham, that's all the questions I had for you. Is there anything you'd like to add? Anything you think our listeners would like to know about Margaret?
No, I think she got the best laugh she had was when you wished her many more birthdays, so she really found that funny. She's got a good sense of humor.
Oh, indeed she does, Graham. That was such a treat to speak with her, and I'll never forget that. Thanks so much for your time, and hope to speak soon.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime, Bill.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.